Hi, this is Dougal Jeppy with Colliers. Welcome to the third episode of the Office Space podcast. And I am very excited to have Francesco De Camille on with me, who is a colleague of mine at Colliers and runs, he is the head of our flexible workspace consulting group. Welcome, Francesco.
Thanks, Dougal. Thanks for having me on.
So, flexible workspace, co-working. Some people, can look at it as kind of a newer trend. It's been going on for a while now. Certainly as a tenant representation broker, we've been seeing it in many fashions. Everyone's been talking about WeWork. I think the general public has seen ad nauseam news about the future and the demise and et cetera about WeWork. But today's discussion is going to be about the future of co-working, and I'm really fortunate to have Francesco's time because we're just coming off hot off of a Zoom meeting he had with really the preeminent providers in the space, from IWG, who owns Regus, Convene, WeWork, Industrious. Am I missing anyone?
IWG, Convene, Industrious, WeWork, Serendipity Labs, and Tishman Speyer, which has their
Yes.
own studio flex brand.
Yes. And Francesco hosted that. How many people were on that call, you think?
Just under 2,000.
No pressure.
Not too
Right?
shabby.
Yeah. So it's great. We've got some really relevant information here. We're going to touch on some of those. So why don't we just dive right into it? Francesco, maybe you can tell us something about yourself and how you got into this area.
Sure. Thanks again, Dougal. So, as you mentioned, my name's Francesco, and I head up our flexible workspace consulting practice for Colliers, focused on the Americas. I have two counterparts. One of them, Tom Slay, is based in London, and the other is Johnny Wright, and he's based in Hong Kong. So, I have a relatively non-traditional background as far as real estate. I started my career actually at BizNow Media, the news and events platform. So I joined when it was a relatively unheard of operation out of New York with a handful of people. I was right out of college, and I ended up staying there for about 7 years. Launched, market after market. Ultimately, I became the chief operating officer of BizNow after Mark BizNow, the founder, sold it off. And so after a few years after we sold the company, I was ready for my next adventure, and Flex Office was really starting to take off. Especially in New York City. And this was a couple years after WeWork was founded, and there was this new player in town, Knotel, that was really the up and comer that was taking a slightly different approach. And so, after being in a mid-market business for a number of years, I saw the exciting opportunity to take advantage of this trend and join a hot company that really, to me at the time, felt like a company that, the moon was the limit, and had some serious unicorn potential. So that's how I got into Flex, and in my role there, I led a sales and marketing team really responsible for driving demand into the Knotels. And so I ended up at Colliers less than 6 months ago, but I've been excited to be here. And my job at Colliers really focuses around how to help our largest occupiers further their adoption and understanding of Flex to take advantage of this new offering.
Very cool. Thanks. As a side note, my experience with co-working was upwards of, I want to say, about 12 years ago. I was hired by Steelcase, which started something called WorkSpring. Did you ever hear about WorkSpring? It was one of the, gosh, maybe it was longer than 12 years ago, probably like 14 years ago, but they were one of the first in the co-working space, and it was really a neat idea. Furniture manufacturer, we're going to create this flexible work environment. And they had a hub and spoke model. Long story short is there was a period in time where they had an opportunity to invest in it and reinvest in it. And they decided, we don't really think this co-working thing is going to go anywhere. And we opened up a handful of sites. And from my perspective, they lost a real opportunity. In any event, that was my kind of introduction, and I remember thinking, co-working, what really kind of what is this? And so how long has it really been around?
Well, if you really want to put your historian's hat on, so ServCorp really launched the first serviced office center. And that's really what it was called up until really, I think, 2010-ish after WeWork launched. That was 1979. So back in Australia, I believe. And then Regus came onto the scenes, I think, in the 80s. And really, ServCorp, Regus, and other traditional, more serviced office or business center type of businesses dominated the space up until really the late 21st century when WeWork launched, was around 2009. And WeWork really blew the gasket open for a number of other companies to follow. And they sort of, I think, in many ways, birthed what came to be known as the flex industry. Prior to that, it was, serviced office was really for, satellite companies or satellite units of large corporations. But WeWork really took a different approach, and they wanted to become the headquarters for companies. And so WeWork came on the scene in 2009. After that, you saw a number of companies come out, like Industrious, Convene, and a number of others.
Hard to believe WeWork's been around for 10 years. Wow. Okay, so let's dive into some of these areas. And I think from the audience, as tenants are thinking about membership agreements, the different kinds of operators, obviously, it's got to be under the context of pre-COVID and post-COVID. So if you could talk for a minute about what some of the trends were pre-COVID within the flexible workplace environment, and then where you see them moving forward.
Yeah, so I would say pre-COVID and really I'll back up even further. So pre-Q4 and the whole WeWork IPO debacle, the prevailing trend amongst the operators was growth at all costs. So operators largely chasing WeWork's tail were laser focused on expanding their networks. And the consensus, having worked at a large operator, was if you could be the first, or if you could be one of the first to have a presence in the top 20, 25 global cities, you can really unlock partnerships with the Fortune 500 companies who will only work with you in a really scalable, programmatic way if you have a presence in all of the cities where they have to be. And so that was the growth. It was the focus. It was growth. And then WeWork's IPO came along, and obviously there was a lot of doubt cast upon the business model. And so investors started asking questions not only of WeWork but of all of the others. And so everything became about profitability. How can we build a profitable and sustainable model? And so I think if you track the amount of times the word profitability appeared in media articles from top five operators and their
Right.
CEOs pre and post WeWork's IPO, you'd see a funny little visual showing this trend. And so that's kind of what the name of the game was. And then, of course, came COVID, and COVID-19 upended the entire world, not just the flex sector, but in many ways within the flex sector. It really did amplify some of the trends that were already happening. One of them is certainly profitability in this sort of cash constrained environment. That's critical. And, I spoke a little bit about that. But the other is enterprise focused solutions. So as some of the smaller users of flex space dry up, the SMB users, the larger occupiers are really the lifeline for the larger flex operators. And so they need to adapt their solutions for these enterprises. And what that started to look like even before COVID was let a smaller focus on mainstream co-working and a larger focus on serving corporates who want full floor, private, dedicated, secure, custom branding in a flexible format. And so now with COVID and the pandemic and the emphasis on social distancing, only has the needs around security and privacy and having sort of dedicated space been amplified. And so I think that's the real trend. And so we're going to see continued focus on enterprise solutions and profitability.
Enterprise solutions and profitability, the ever elusive profitability in these fast growing companies, right? No matter if they're flex co-working or high growth tech, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a syndrome of a larger sort of problem, if you will, happening at large within the tech world. And you know, and I have to say, having worked at Knotel, which in many ways was the runner-up to WeWork, we had to do what we did. We had to take down more space because it was our way of competing with WeWork, and WeWork was the shining star that everyone was running after. And so, and in a way, you know, look, you can criticize Adam Neumann, you can criticize WeWork, in hindsight, but they also, given the amount of capital that they raised, they had a mandate that they had to use it to grow at this pace and scale that they did. And so, fundamentally, I think if you really kind of peel the onion back, there's some more fundamental structural issues happening at the top of the VC pyramid and sort of how these companies ultimately had to operate under the construct of the returns that they were required to generate.
While we're talking on the WeWork side, what is, in your opinion, the future of WeWork? Are they going to survive this? Are they going to where are they going to be, let's say, a year from now, even
Yeah.
as an operator?
So, in my view, WeWork's long-term success really hinges on the answer to two simple questions. The first is, can the new leadership make them profitable? And two, will that happen before they run out of money? Right? And so for me, the answer to the first question is actually a resounding yes. I do think, given the right amount of capital and time, I'm a big fan of their new CEO, Sandeep, and their leadership team. I think they can do it. They're already taking the right steps. They're really minimizing non-core products. They're trimming down SG&A. They're looking to restructure their leases. I think given it enough time, there's a real business there, and it's a matter of time. And so the question is, will there, I think it's around $4 billion of current runway, be enough to hold them over? So that's to me the question. And you know, a lot of people talk about where, you know, where did WeWork go wrong, and how will they sort of dig themselves out? And the problem with WeWork is they're just saddled with so much operational, financial, and now reputational debt that they have a pretty big hole to dig themselves out to. But fundamentally, I think they can do it. They just need a little bit of time, and enough money.
Well, I have a number of clients that have really, they're not going to renew. They've canceled their enterprise agreements, a variety of different, and I think from a PR standpoint, they have some work to do. I just yesterday I actually toured a number of co-working facilities for a client. First tour in 70 days, by the way, in the COVID environment, and toured a number of operators, and it was great to kind of see. It was great to kind of be out and seeing them again and understanding their differences and hear what clients are thinking about. But then it was also a little harrowing to see so much empty space. And that's true of any office building. But to be, part of the excitement of being in a co-working facility is the buzz, and there's no buzz right now. One question is, and you may not know the answer, is when is that buzz going to come back? When are co-working providers going to start seeing members coming back and into their spaces?
Well, I will say we had a webinar yesterday that you alluded to in the beginning, and we saw some early signs of optimism from WeWork. So Beth Moore, the head of US portfolio sales from WeWork, did a talk, and part of her talk focused on what they were seeing in Asia. And she shared with us some normally quite sensitive building card access data, and it showed a pretty significant spike in the last month in Asia. So starting really the beginning of May in Asia, that indicated people are really coming back into the office. Now, I think here stateside, given that we haven't gone through one or two pandemics before, I think it's going to take us a little bit longer to get comfortable with some of the requirements that are going to be necessary, things like taking our temperatures, wearing masks, sitting 6 feet apart. I think we all say we miss the office. A lot of us, you know, say, okay, maybe we'll work 1 or 2 days from home, but we still miss fundamentally being in the office. I don't think what we miss, though, is sitting 6 feet apart, wearing masks. And so I think that piece of it is certainly going to make the recovery a little bit longer and harder for us. And I do unfortunately think the flexible workspace sector is going to disproportionately be impacted given their typically hyper dense environments. The what's yet to be seen though is how some of these operators, and I think Convene and Industrious and WeWork and others, are doing a good job of really showing occupiers in the broader world what measures they're taking to really implement health and safety protocols in their spaces. And so, you know, if occupiers become confident in these steps that they're taking, perhaps, you know, we'll see them coming back in the next few months. But it's you know, everyone thinks they have the crystal ball, so I won't give you a date, but it's certainly gonna it's at least up, you know, encouraging that we're seeing people come back now in Asia.
Right. And as was talked about in your discussion, Beth Moore mentioned that China had the highest sales ever. Right?
Yeah.
For
yeah, it's interesting.
Which is amazing
I
to
think,
me.
So on the one hand, you know, there's this sort of story of opposing forces playing out. On the one hand, you know, there's some fundamental issues that flex spaces pose in an era of social distancing, right? But on the other hand, the benefits, the advantages of flex space is flexibility, right? And I think right now, more so than ever, clients who are grappling with how to manage near-term uncertainty around headcount, risk, the attractiveness of having, you know, complete flexibility in the term is trumping some of those other concerns. And so I think we're seeing two things. We're seeing a flight to flexibility and a flight to quality happening right now with occupiers. And in a way, again, even those two words sometimes are sort of contrasting in when you're looking at a flex space. Sometimes flex spaces aren't considered to be the highest quality spaces relative to, you know, an expensive traditional lease in a Class A building. But fundamentally, they're flexible. And so what I'm hearing from WeWork is that spike in the pipeline is the result of a lot of traditional companies that haven't considered flex coming to WeWork as a business continuity solution, as a more flexible alternative than a traditional lease, as they're coming up on a lease renewal and only want to sign a commitment for the next 6 to 12 months.
Do you think in light of that, in terms of what they're seeing in China and the other operators, assuming they're seeing some of the same things in the markets and countries that are coming back, I assume there is going to be pressure on pricing and it would lower membership pricing in the States. Do you see that changing or even really changing at all in light of what they're seeing in China and other markets?
So in terms of pricing, I've yet to see any prices soften. My suspicion is that they will, largely because the unit economics of a flex space tend to function around really packing people in and creating efficiency of the floor plate and fitting in more people per unit square foot. And that's how they really create value. And so if an occupier can't utilize that value because they're locked into complying with, you know, social distancing measures that maybe their corporate counterparts are putting into place, requiring that, you know, you can't be less than 200 square feet per employee, all of a sudden a flex space becomes a bit uneconomical. So I think in order to counteract that, flex spaces might have to soften their pricing a bit to not make them too cost prohibitive for occupiers.
Right. Got it. Well, that makes sense. So one of the areas, it was discussed on your call yesterday, and we're starting to see it in other markets, is the growth in suburban locations. Personally, you know, I live in the northern suburbs of Chicago, and I'm working from home mostly right now, but I've always had the flexibility to work wherever. I personally appreciate the office. We have a new office. It's my team's there. It's more invigorating and I'm more focused, but it might be nice to have a flexible workplace nearby that I could pop into. So someone like me, you know, is there going to be a growth in suburban flexible work?
So I'm a big believer that there's going to be a pretty material rise in use of suburban co-working, and that's going to be that's going to contribute to an increase in supply. So certainly we're all working from home right now. We're all looking forward to getting back to work, but I think a lot of us might want to avoid a long commute. And so what we're hearing, I would say also within Colliers, I've heard this, is that our employees want to have workspace offerings near where they work. And so there are a number of co-working companies that have a presence in the suburbs. And so, a large advocate of this who spoke yesterday actually was John Arenas of Serendipity Labs, who's really sort of invested in suburban co-working. There are other companies like VentureX that have done a good job of this too. And I think so I think we're going to see a big rise as people work less and less out of their urban offices. And another trend that you might see that I think is yet really to be is yet really significant in terms of the supply, but is multifamily and residential landlords building in co-working into the first or second floors of their buildings as amenity space for tenants. I think as we become sort of as our work life balance sort of the integration becomes more integrated, right? I think we'll see maybe not only an increase in rise of co-working facilities in the suburbs, but potentially even a rise of co-working centers into, what's traditionally considered a multifamily apartment building. And so I think, one more thing that, I think is really a trend, and we spoke about this too yesterday, is the future of work is all about choice, right? And so you want to work wherever's most productive to you, whenever's most productive to you. And so we as employers want to bring the workplace as close as we can to the employee. And so if that means bringing people options in co-working centers or other alternatives, even in remote work setups, I think that's going to be a big part of the future to retain and attract talent.
Right, that all makes sense. Yeah, and when companies are when tenants are looking at membership agreements versus leases, have you found from your experience, do most of those membership agreements look the same? Or what are some of the pitfalls and in things that members should be considering when they're looking at signing up, and realizing, you know, there's different flavors for each one. Is there like a checklist, or what's the process, the best process in your opinion for a user to evaluate these different co-working providers?
Well, so look, I'd say beyond location and price point, part of a flexible workspace offering is a turnkey experience. And so that includes furniture, that includes IT, that includes meeting space, that includes, in some cases, F&B. And so I would get really comfortable with the actual workspace design. Is are the seats right for you? Is the furniture right for you? Is the level of privacy right for you? Are there enough meeting rooms for you? And certainly for larger companies, experienced project managers are very focused on ensuring that the IT specifications and privacy specifications are right for the member company. Other things to look at, I would say, just general tips when signing a membership agreement with a flex operator are beyond the scope around IT, furniture, et cetera, is look at the transferability. Some of these operators have leases on spaces, right? They don't own their spaces. And so they have sometimes built into their membership agreements the ability to move tenants around if they don't renew on their leases. And so that's a pretty poor user experience for a tenant to have to move to another location. Another is, what are the incremental fees that you'll experience beyond your monthly rent? So if you're going to be using common area amenities like the printers or the common the com excuse me the conference rooms or F&B, take a look at the extra fees and ask how other members experience and what sort of the share they should be of the overall rent. And then finally, look at auto renewals. These are not, as you said, these are not leases, these are licensing agreements, and they tend to have auto renewal triggers. And so you certainly don't want to be caught into one of those if you don't want to renew your space.
Yeah. All good points, and it sounds like each membership agreement is a little bit different. So it's important to have an advisor that understands that. Well, good. This has been great. I really appreciate your time, and the flexible workplace environment and an industry is really in an amazing. I'm fascinated with where it's gonna go, and we know it's not going away. It'll morph. There'll be some winners and losers out of this, I'm sure, but it's here to stay, and users will be using them moving forward. So thank you very much, Francesco, for your time, and appreciate it.
Look, thank you, Dougal. This was great. Maybe 6 to 12 months from now, we can do another once we have we see how things shake out. All right.
Great call. We'll
Thanks.
plan on it. So, okay. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.